This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross.
My name is RuPaul, supermodel of the world. You know, when I started out right here in this neighborhood, they told me I couldn't make it. They said, wasn't no big black drag queen in the pop world, and you ain't gonna do it. And look at the bitch now.
That's my guest, RuPaul Charles, America's drag queen sweetheart, from the 1995 documentary Wigstock, the movie. There's a classic line from transvestite theater that sums up RuPaul's onstage persona, if such a thing is possible. I'm more man than you'll ever be, and more woman than you'll ever have. RuPaul Charles, the man, is a lean 6'6" tall, with freckles and cropped curly hair. RuPaul, the glamazon drag queen goddess, adds 6 inches in heels and about 5 in blonde tresses, with enviable endless legs, a tiny waist, and flawless cheekbones. Through an unusual blend of showbiz savvy and positive message, RuPaul Charles has managed to bring cross-dressing into the American pop culture mainstream. He's topped the dance charts with his disco songs, hosted his own VH1 talk show, become the spokesperson for the popular MAC cosmetics line, and scored roles in high-profile films, both in and out of drag. He's appearing in the new film, But I'm a Cheerleader, a gender-bender comedy about sexual orientation. Charles plays Mike, a formerly gay man who's a rehab counselor at True Directions, a clinic for gay high school students whose parents want them reprogrammed to be straight. In this scene, Mike is called in on an intervention with a cheerleader, played by Natasha Lyonne, whose family and friends confront her with their suspicions.
Honey, we think you're a lesbian.
I myself was once a gay. Now I'm an ex-gay, Megan. I work for a place called True Directions who help people like yourself learn to understand the reasons behind homosexual tendencies and how to heal them.
What tendencies? Why would you think I'm a...
You've been trying to make us eat this tofu.
In diet, watch for a switch to vegetarianism.
You don't have any pictures of guys in your locker, just these.
Mm-hmm. These. Sexual. Even vaginal motifs in artwork and decorating. Gay iconography.
You don't even like to kiss me.
It's true.
I can't believe this.
Denial is a normal part of the healing process that we'll explore at True Directions.
RuPaul Charles, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hey.
I'd like you to describe your character, Mike, for us.
My character, Mike, in But I'm a Cheerleader, is a reformed gay person who is the male camp leader at a camp where they reform young gay kids into being straight kids. And it was fun to do because it's so absurd. I didn't mention the movie is a comedy.
I gotcha. What did the producers or the director of the film say about your role and what you bring to it, or what they imagined you would bring to it?
Well, you know, it's really a surreal look at something that could be really dangerous. You know, we're talking about teaching people or programming people to not trust their instincts or their feelings and their intuitive magic that everybody has. And that's a really scary thing. So, you know, making a comedy out of something that could be really dangerous is some touchy stuff. You know, in fact, my character, Mike, does what I do in my glamour drag, but the complete opposite, in the complete opposite direction, to the extreme. You know, there's a lot of crotch grabbing and spitting and posing, and that was fun because it's basically what I do in drag, just the opposite.
Now, you grew up in San Diego. Your father worked at McDonnell Douglas, and you had three sisters, older twin sisters and a younger sister. It sounds like your parents' marriage was pretty stormy. Did they fight a lot in front of you kids?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. In fact, I was just recently writing my new bio out for my website, and I remember us, whenever they start fighting, us kids would run into the back room and huddle down in this one corner by the dresser, like it were an air raid, you know. And it was interesting because when I saw The Prince of Tides and the kids in the movie did the same thing, they would actually go and jump in the lake and go underwater where they couldn't hear anything. I was like, I was so shaken up when I saw that movie. But, you know, we didn't get beaten. We didn't get... there was no sexual abuse. There was nothing like that. And when I look back at my childhood, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was. It was bad. I mean, no kid should have to keep secrets and grow up in that type of war zone. But, you know, it could have been a lot worse.
What did you have to keep secrets about?
Well, you know, when my parents separated, we had to keep secrets from the other parent. You know, my mother would have it to, you know, we couldn't tell things that she was doing to my father. My father didn't want us to tell her things. And then we had to keep secrets from the social workers because we were on public assistance, and there were things that my mother didn't want the social workers to know about, you know, whether she got some extra money babysitting or that kind of stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. And immediately, when a kid is brought into that situation, you're taught to... you know, you can't be a kid anymore. Your innocence is gone, and you have to start keeping secrets. And it's the same within this movie. When you're taught to not trust your instincts, when something wrong is really happening, and you ask your parent, "Mommy, something, what's wrong?" And your parent says, "I'm fine. Everything is fine." You then your instinct is really thrown for a loop because you know instinctively that something's wrong, but you don't trust that because the person you trust is telling you, no, everything's fine.
Now, when you were little, people mistook you for a girl.
Yeah.
What did they see there that made them think that?
Well, I was a cute kid is what I saw there. You know, I was... beautiful, beautiful kid. So yeah, but you know, a lot of little boys are mistaken for girls. I grew up in a house full of girls, so I did have feminine characteristics. But that didn't really end until I was 15. It probably had a lot to do with the fact that I had this huge afro. So you know, and you know, I was a cute kid and sweet disposition.
Now, San Diego is not exactly a black town. How racially segregated was it there?
Well, you know, it's taken me years of therapy to be even able to say I'm from San Diego because I don't have an emotional attachment to San Diego. It's a beautiful place, lovely, clean air. Kids can have an age of innocence, at least when I was growing up there. But I never found my place there, you know. It's very Republican, conservative, very white, and very segregated. A visitor may not see that, but growing up there, you know, you really get it. And I really didn't hit my mark, I felt, until I moved to Atlanta, Georgia, when I was just turning 15. Around that time, I moved to Atlanta, Georgia. And then I thought, okay, I'm home now. Because there's a mixture of people, and there were definitely more brown-skinned people there. And generally, people are... warmer in a more sincere way. In San Diego, as with, I think, all of California, which is where I live now, there's a superficial niceness that I've never been able to buy, you know. Even as a kid, I knew there's something behind that smile that's not so cute.
So when, as a child, did you first start experimenting wearing women's clothes?
Well, you know, my sister Renata tells me that I used to dress up this pink dress of hers when I was 5 years old. I don't remember that, so I'm going to take her word for it. But, you know, because my mother was such so rebellious, I never felt confined to blacks here, whites here, boys here, girls there. I always felt like I was a visitor from another planet, visiting this strange land. And yes, they were backwards and really idiotic at times, but you know, I'm here for the visitation, and it's just a short ride, so let's cool it. So I always used all the colors in the crayon box, and there was never a sexual connotation attached to it. I dressed up as a cowboy. I was having fun. You know, there was never any sexual thing attached to it, the way other people attached a sexual perversity to it, something subversive.
Did you dress up as a kid and put on shows?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It was one way for me to get my mom's attention. You know, I love the Carol Burnett Show, so I would do all the performers on her show, like I would do Charo and Tina Turner and Little Richard and Elvis and anything I could do to get my mom's attention, and she loved it. She loved it. It took her out of her own drama for a minute.
My guest is RuPaul Charles. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. RuPaul Charles is my guest. He's best known for his performance as RuPaul, supermodel to the world. He's a drag performer and actor. He's a former VH1 television talk show host.
And I can bake a cherry pie.
And all that and more. And he's a singer. You left home at 15, and you moved in with one of your older sisters and her husband in Atlanta. And at that time, Atlanta really did have this burgeoning gay scene. Was that your first exposure to real drag culture?
Atlanta, yes, definitely. When I was about 12 in San Diego, my sister, who was always fashion forward, had a picture framed of the disco star Sylvester. And at that, the picture she had was of him in drag. And I remember asking her questions about it. And she said, well, he was in a group in San Francisco that I probably can't say the name on public radio, but it was a very famous group in San Francisco. And then he branched off during the disco years to become a solo artist and create a name for himself. And that was the first time I realized they were actual drag queens, not in the Milton Berle, Flip Wilson ilk, which were just comedians making fun of women. This wasn't making fun of women. This was like, you know, a political statement saying, you know, you're not going to tell me what I can do, what I can't do, and that this is about being as beautiful and fun and having fun with all the toys in the playground.
Were you already out in terms of your sexuality?
I've never really been in the closet. Never was. When I was a kid, I think I was probably maybe 5 or 6. Kids in the neighborhood said, you know, you are a sissy. You are really a sissy. And I didn't know what that meant then, but I knew that that meant that I wasn't what they were doing. I was different. And so I never really was. I never really had to have that big conversation with my mother or my father. Although I did have a confrontation with my father when I was 17, because he had heard, it's a weird story. My sister Renee, who's older than me, said, you know, Daddy's going to want to talk to you because he says that someone told him that they saw you hanging around with these people that they knew were gay, you know. So Daddy's going to want to talk to you. So I said, fine, you know. And so we went and we talked, and I told him, you know, he told me the story, and I told him, you know, it's really interesting that you would come around and talk to me about this now when at other times when I really needed you to talk to me and tell me, give me guidance, you weren't there. But for this, you want to come and talk to me for this, you know? And this was 1977 when we had this conversation, and you know, I was feeling no shame about being who I am at all, you know.
So you were in Atlanta in the 70s. What drag style was in vogue then?
Well, what drag style was, you know, the gay rights movement was in full swing, and everybody was having a party. And I remember going to a club in Atlanta probably around the time I was 17, and I saw a drag queen perform a Donna Summer song. And I couldn't believe that was not Donna Summer. I thought, the only way I knew that wasn't Donna Summer was that this Donna Summer's legs were really long and gorgeous, and she danced around a lot more than Donna Summer danced around. And I was gobsmacked. I was just amazed. And Atlanta is, the whole South is always celebrated eccentricity, and it was just applauded. I moved to Atlanta and enrolled in the Northside School of Performing Arts, which is a magnet school for the public schools in Atlanta. And I was around a bunch of other kids who thought and had views as I did. And it was the first time I really felt like I was at home. The Atlanta, I call it like my bar mitzvah, which was when I sort of came into bloom as a human. I felt like I was doing hard time in San Diego before that.
The first time you appeared in full drag, what did you wear?
I wore, professionally, you know, ever since I was a kid, I always considered myself hippie, punk, nonconformist. So I always dressed differently and had fun with it. So, so it's hard for me, and I consider drag everything you can put on. You know, I think you're born naked and the rest is drag. But professionally in drag, I was in Atlanta, Georgia, in a band, and we decided it was a punk era, so we were doing sort of a smear on the Reagan 80s, and we just would wear combat boots with smeared lipstick and raggedy old wigs and stuff. And the first time was just for show gimmicks, and everybody the girls in the band dressed up as guys, and the guys in the band dressed up as girls, and it was all for laughs. But everybody looked at me and said, "Miss Girl, you got it going on. Look at those legs and all this stuff." And I remember thinking, And there was a file open in my head thinking, this is interesting. It wasn't until many years later I knew that I could really do something with this, and that it could be my thing that I really take to the umpteenth degree.
What was then the inspiration for the super glam look, which you embody now? Were you just following the trends in transvestite culture?
Well, what had happened was after I'd become a big fish in a small pond in Atlanta and created a name for myself. And then in 1987, I moved to New York because it was time. And at that time in New York, I had to start at the very bottom. And the call for work at that time was go-go dancers who were drag queens, who could look, sexy. And I'd never done that sort of sexy thing. It was always for laughs, So moved to New York, needed the money, so I started go-go dancing on the bar at the Pyramid Club in the East Village.
On the bar? Were you in a cage or just on the bar?
No cage. It was just they'd have drag queens and sexy boys, and anybody who looked freaky would dance on the bar, and you get $40 a night. And to make up for my $40 a night, I was a very good go-go dancer. It's not even about the dancing, it's about the attitude and how many connections you can make with people while you're up on the bar or the go-go box. So I would walk out of there, I'd get my $40 a night, but I'd end up having $120 in $1 bills from tips. And none of the other people would get tips. But I would, lick my finger and just, I would do attitude dancing. I was, posing, and I'd say, come here, what's your name, You got some money for me? Come on, baby, give me a dollar. And I would make money. That's what happened. And a few years in New York, I became very popular and became the Queen of Manhattan, which is an annual award the downtown club people would give to a guy and a gal, could be a guy gal or a girl guy, it doesn't matter, but there'd be a prince, a king and a queen of Manhattan. And I was crowned that in 1990. And after I was crowned queen of Manhattan, and after my year was up, I decided, okay, well, I've just did the pinnacle of underground club world in New York. Let's go above ground. And what happened was, I thought, well, to go above ground, I'm not going to be able to do it in drag. So I decided to do my androgynous look and go out and perform and get a demo tape together and go out and perform. So I did that. But everywhere I went, people would say, I love the show. When are you going to start doing, you know, your black hooker look again? When are you going to do your you know, you're the fiercest drag queen alive. When are you going to do that? And then it dawned on me. It was like an epiphany. I realized, what am I doing? I am the fiercest drag queen ever. Why don't I just get into drag and then turn the volume up to 45? You know, I love in that Woody Allen movie, I think it's Stardust Memories, where the aliens visit him. And he says, well, what should I do? What should I be doing with my life? And they say, you're a funny guy. Make funny movies. It's as simple as that. You know, I was a fierce drag queen. Become an even fiercer drag queen. So that's when the Glamorama, Glamazon drag came in. I thought, okay, well, before my look had been black hooker, which was sexy, trashy, you know, I decided to take it to the umpteenth degree and do couture clothes, do blonde hair on brown skin, do really beautiful makeup like from the magazines, and just make it perfect. And I sent my demo tape out with those pictures, and voila, I got a record contract.
RuPaul Charles will be back in the second half of our show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue our interview with RuPaul Charles, actor and drag performer extraordinaire. Charles appears as a man in the new film But I'm a Cheerleader, a comedy of sexual disorientation. Part of RuPaul's allure as a drag diva are his fabulous good looks. We wondered about his beauty secrets. RuPaul, your look is so utter glam femme. It involves, I imagine, a violent amount of makeup and work to get it right. What does your routine involve?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. You know, I'm a drag performer, but I think anybody who's ever stepped on stage, actually any civilian who goes to some office building in one of those suits with the sneakers is in drag. And it's for me, in my life, I've been able to look at our culture from an interesting perspective, and we're all doing the same things. We're all kids playing dress up. And, you know, it's easy to say, oh, well, it's obvious that I'm in drag. I'm dressing up in quote unquote women's clothes, but, we're all doing it. I'm sitting right now talking to you I'm in a Prada suit with some, gorgeous, red, I think these are Valentino shoes, and it's a man's suit. It's everything is all masculine, but it's total drag. It's total, like, I'm playing dress up, and I love to do it. Any woman who's in show business, from Cindy Crawford to Sharon Stone, she would have the same amount of makeup and people and clothes and stuff and paraphernalia that I would have. It's just that our culture, it's easy for us, for everybody to say, oh, well, see, there, he's in drag, and it takes him 3 hours to get ready because he's a drag, because he's a man. Honey, everybody who does that amount of clothes and makeup and stuff, 3 hours, even more, hair, makeup, lip liner, contouring. I don't care if the girl is 17 to 55, it's going to take that amount of get up and go.
I believe you. I want you to give up the goods, though. I really want to know how you look so fabulous.
Well, and it's bone structure, darling. there's a ton of tricks, and they're not just drag tricks. They're tricks that every glamour girl knows, and it's they're passed down through the ages. You know, but people say I dress up in women's clothes. Women don't dress that way. Only drag queens dress that way, whether it be a male drag queen or a female drag queen. You know, Sharon Stone is a drag queen, and people laugh at that, ha ha ha. But it's the truth. It is the truth. doesn't mean she's a man. It means that she gets up into drag. This week I'm appearing on VIP. I'm taping it this week. And Pam Anderson and I joke about, you know, who's doing more drag than who. She's
well,
total
well,
drag
you're,
queen.
You're really up against your match with Pamela Anderson.
Hello.
but I have to ask you, do you wear a corset?
I do all the, I'll do whatever, by any means necessary. You're not going to get a straight answer out of me. I do it all.
Come on, you give it to Liz Smith. Why can't I get you to tell me?
Well, yes, I do. I wear corsets, not because I need one, because I'm rail thin, but I wear it because it gives me that extra edge. It gives me anything I can use to take it to the umpteenth degree. I'll do it. I haven't done any type of surgery, and I probably wouldn't. It doesn't mean that much to me. It's not that important to me. Sure, you know, corset. I'll use tapes to tape to give myself tighter skin. You know, I it's hard to describe what tapes are to a civilian, but you everybody, every glamour girl knows exactly what they are. You basically tape your face back to take out certain lines and to give more definition in places. Mm-hmm. You know,
how do you create cleavage?
Well, you know, it's not rocket science. You basically, you get a push-up bra, and men have, I'll tell you, I'll give you the secret. Men have pectoral muscles, and if those pectoral muscles are squeezed together, they look like cleavage. So if but you have to have on something tight to hold them close together.
You also use something called tucking panties.
I knew you were going to get to tucking panties. Well,
got to get there.
You remember the old Taco Bell campaign, run for the border? Well, basically, you take your business and you tuck it to the border, and so that you have a fierce tuck going on. If for civilians, tuck means you flatten out your crotch area. That's a pretty picture, isn't it?
Yeah, sounds a little painful. I mean, all of it, not just the last bit.
Well, glamour is pain, and because we're talking about the idea of glamour, glamour is a man-made idea that you know, that our culture worships. You know, if you think about it, the men created these shoes that are so high like that, I guess to make women's legs look great or longer or whatever. But she can't walk in them. She can't run away. She's totally. You know, the corset, you can't breathe in them. So you're basically, you know, powerless. And the way drags do this thing, it's making fun of that.
RuPaul Charles, thanks so much for talking with me on Fresh Air. It was a fun ride.
Thank you, Barbara.
RuPaul Charles. He's in the new comedy, But I'm a Cheerleader. He's also the narrator of the new documentary film, The Eyes of Tammy Faye. Coming up, Girl Power. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.